The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. Welcome, welcome. Really warm welcome. So, today I'd like to talk a little bit about thinking and meditation. Often, the meditation instructions, or certainly mindfulness instructions, are just to notice our thoughts. And that's a fantastic practice, and it can be very effective, and it's a great way to go. But it's not the only way to work with thoughts, and maybe sometimes something a little bit different is needed. So, can we work with the thinking mind in a way that goes beyond just being mindful of thoughts when the occasion arises, but to use the mind as an ally and use it as a support for our practice? It is a powerful tool, are the mind. Of course it is. And there's this way that there are some analogies or similes that are used in the suttas of like a cloth being better able to take up dye if it doesn't have stains. Right? So the dye just won't, it'll either not be taken up where that stain is, or maybe it shows up darker or something like this. So when the cloth isn't filled with stains, we might consider that the dye represents some concentration or goodwill. You know, some boundlessness, some openness, something like this. Or in the same way that when there's a cloth that isn't filled with stains, it's better able to like clean and polish whatever needs to be cleaned and polished, maybe even including itself. So is there some way in which we might consider that the mind is like a cloth in these similes? But for some of us, this idea of like actively using the mind during meditation can be a big shift, can be really different than what we're accustomed to. We may have this habit of we just use the mind in a certain way during meditation. Or, and so we have this idea that with our meditation practice, it's just about doing more of the same, maybe longer or deeper, whatever we've been doing with the mind. And to actively do something different might feel uncomfortable. For example, we may be attached to these ideas that there should be a sense of not knowing, like that's the most important thing. And so for us, to meditation practice is associated with falling into a soft, cushiony, cottony, maybe foggy, blurry space that initially can have a certain amount of comfort because it's insulated from the outside world, perhaps. But then often you can find that the energy drops out of a practice like that, and there can't be any wisdom that arises in this kind of this dullness. But there might be this idea that there should be not knowing, and we kind of try to shut down all of our mental activity and instead fall into what sometimes is called sinking mind. Or alternatively, we might have an idea that with meditation, we is finally an opportunity for us to figure things out, figure out ourselves, like why we do what we do, or what's underneath that trouble, niggling mind, or thoughts that we might have, or something. And so we're doing some archaeological dig in our thought processes. There's lots of different ideas that we might have about the role of thinking and the mind during meditation. And there's a number of ways in which we might use the mind, but that requires that we put down any notions about what should be happening with the mind, with thinking during meditation. And including putting aside the idea that there shouldn't be any thinking whatsoever, but instead to start wherever you are. And we use the mind in particular ways to be a support. So the practice doesn't require that our minds not be engaged in order to move towards greater and greater freedom. Instead, the practice is to find freedom while the mind is engaged. So one way is I've been using just this word thoughts kind of in a generic way, you know, just clumping them all together. But in fact, you know, there's lots of different types of thoughts, and certainly it changes during the course of meditation. It might be with a longer meditation period at the beginning is we sit down and there's this thinking mind is definitely present, and there's kind of a strong momentum. There's this maybe a compulsive feeling to thinking that there's this can't be stopped, and there's one train of thought after another after another. Maybe the thoughts seem loud or solid or authoritative and happening in a rapid succession. So maybe when we first sit down, that's what we discover. But as the mind starts to settle, as the body starts to settle, as the meditation period progresses, then thinking kind of becomes a little bit softer, a little bit less compelling, and maybe with not a sense of rapidity like there was before. Then with greater meditative clarity, with greater stillness, the thinking can then be a little bit more light or thin or still. Definitely less authoritative, less solid. And there may be a way in which the thoughts like float into the mind, and the meditator doesn't really have that much interest in getting tangled up with them, isn't so identified with them. They're not seen as a problem, necessarily. And there might even be some gaps of silence in between the thoughts. And then, as meditation period progresses, this might only be experienced on retreat, or with longer meditation sessions, or maybe after some time of practice. So really, beginners often don't have this experience, but there's this, the thoughts see, arise, and they're seen just as phenomena. Oh, there's just one more thought. Without any inclination to associate with them or to add any particular importance to them, there might even be kind of a feeling of the creation of a thought, and then the thought arises, and then it passes away, like all things do. So I'm using this word thought, but we can see that as meditation period progresses, or meditation experience progresses, whether that's in one sit, one retreat, one's maybe years of meditation practice, we can see this progression. We can see that this one word thought actually refers to a whole range of things and has different qualities. And it can be helpful to kind of notice the quality, maybe the how authoritative it seems or how solid it seems. Another way to characterize thoughts, sometimes that I find useful, is to think of them as sometimes thoughts feel like they're just long novels, you know, just getting lost with, getting lost in thoughts, getting lost in, you know, just this papancha, getting a proliferation of thoughts. And then maybe as the mind settles, maybe instead of a whole novel, maybe it's just a chapter, and maybe just a paragraph, and then we can get down to a sentence and then a word. So it can be helpful to notice that there's these different qualities, and that it's can be a way in which we interact with the thoughts is to be to notice the different qualities of them is one way to be a little bit removed from them and not to be completely lost in them. And in the suttas, we know that the Buddha to be, that is, before he was awakened, that he worked with thoughts in this way too, also to categorize them. And here's a quote from one of the suttas. Before my awakening, when I was still unawakened but intent on awakening, I thought, why don't I meditate by continually dividing my thoughts into two classes? So I assigned thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming to one class. And I assigned thoughts of renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness to the second class. Then, as I meditated, diligent, keen, and resolute, when a sensual thought arose, I understood, this sensual thought has arisen in me. It leads to affliction for myself. It leads to affliction for others. It leads to affliction for both myself and others. It destroys wisdom. It brings irritation and does not lead to nibbana. When I reflected in this way, the thought went away. So I gave up, got rid of, and eliminated sensual thoughts that arose. Then this continues with thoughts of ill will and thoughts of harming. So the Buddha, he categorized his thoughts on whether are these wholesome, are they helpful, or are they unhelpful and even causing affliction and harm. Do they lead to awakening or do they lead to harm? So this can be a way in which we can interact with our thoughts. Also, like a third way in which we might categorize them, to sense into, is this the way that's leading to greater and greater freedom? And one thing that I appreciate is in this quote is that first the Buddha noticed that he was having thoughts. He wasn't lost in them. That's the first step. The second step, that he did a little bit of noting practice. Oh, this is a thought on sensual thoughts, sensual desires, ill will, harming. And then he subsided, these thoughts subsided when he contemplated, this actually isn't helpful. Doesn't lead to awakening, it causes harm to myself or others or both. So he's actively using his mind here to help him with his thoughts. But sometimes that doesn't work, right? Often what we hear what the Buddha does, it sounds like so easy and so straightforward. And it's true that often there's kind of these idealized scenarios that are portrayed in the suttas. But there's some more ideas about how to work with thoughts in the suttas. And these are some instructions that the Buddha is giving. Here's a quote. He says, when harmful, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, aversion, and delusion arise due to paying attention to a particular object of awareness, then shift one's attention from that object of awareness to another object of awareness that is connected with something wholesome. So this idea that if you notice that you're paying attention to something and there's some sensual desire, maybe there's an individual that you're sexually attracted to and you're lost in sexual fantasies, or maybe there's an individual in which that you have some ill will, some aversion, and you're lost in those thoughts, whether they're lost thoughts of harming, or if it's there's thoughts of how you were harmed, or kind of repeating things, you know, often how these types of thoughts kind of have a real stickiness to them. So the Buddha's suggestion is to replace them, is to switch. If you notice that you're thinking about this, to think about something else. And he gives a simile. It's as if there were a peg in some wood. Then you want to replace it. You have a, like maybe a coarse peg, and you got one that's just a little bit smaller, a little bit more fine. And you take a mallet and kind of like pound it out. And you just replace the more coarse, maybe one that's unwholesome, unhelpful peg with one that's more wholesome and helpful. Fortunately, there's some, gives a little bit more details about this, because maybe it's not that easy to just reflect on, to note the thoughts, to reflect on these aren't helpful, and then to decide, okay, I'm going to try to replace them, but maybe we find it's a little bit difficult to replace them. So there might be some ways in which we can replace them with something that's neutral. And often this is the general instructions that are given, that pay attention to the body. Often I'm giving instructions to, and I do this myself, is to bring attention to the sensations in the feet. There's something about the feet that feel really grounded and connected to the earth, to whatever it is. Even if we're sitting, our feet are, chances are touching something. So to replace thoughts that are troubling and unwholesome and unhelpful with of the body, it can be helpful to do with what the feet are touching or what the hands are touching. Maybe if we're sitting, to feel the pressure of the chair or cushion against our bodies. Or another neutral one often is the breath. Just put a little bit more effort into bringing sensations of breathing. For me, sometimes I find it helpful to set the intention to be with the beginning, middle, and end of an in-breath, or the beginning, middle, and end of an out-breath. And setting that intention brings just enough, a little bit effort to stay with the breath. So that's one way to replace thoughts. But there's some other ways. One is we can replace thoughts of sensual desire, sexual fantasies or something like this, by dismantling the attractiveness. And I appreciate the way that Tenisaro Bhikkhu approaches this, by kind of like visualizing what the body of this other, the desirable other, would be like if we dissected it into its various parts. Not necessarily dissecting with a scalpel, but broke it up or considered all the different parts. So the purpose of doing this is just to help us if we feel like we're lost in just these thoughts of sensual desire in it. So to keep that in mind, so in any time you feel like doing these, this practice leads into disgust or something that feels unhelpful, that's not the direction we're going. Right, this is just to replace the coarse peg with a finer peg, just to replace it with something that's has more wholesomeness to it. So if you feel like a sense of disgust or depression or something like this, then to just drop these practices, I haven't described them yet, but kind of laying the groundwork here, to drop them and just return your attention to the breath. But maybe it's easier to go to the breath after this little interlude. So this practice of thinking about body parts instead of the body as a whole, as a way to dismantle the attractiveness, in some ways we're kind of like dismantling the body. And part of the mind is sure to resist this practice. Like there's a way in which we feel like we have a sense of vitality, or some, I don't know, there's some way in which we are loath to give up some of these, what our minds get lost in. But until we kind of work with that resistance, the mind will continually go this way. So this dismantling what we find attractive is a way in which we can help take some of the power out of this, the mind wanting to get lost in lustful thoughts. So one thing that Tanisro Bhikkhu Tonjeff, that he recommends, which I appreciate very much, is to bring an attitude of humor to this contemplation so that it can shift the obsession that the mind is currently lost in. Just, right, we don't want to get filled with disgust or depression or anything like this. We're just trying to help ourselves get out of our rut, perhaps, with our thinking. So Tanjeff says to keep it lighthearted, this exploration. Okay, so how is this? First of all, we need to use our imagination, of course, right? There's no other way. So here's a way in which our mind can be our ally, is to use our imagination. And you can imagine that this person that you're very attracted to, and you might imagine that they have beautiful hair, let's say, luscious hair, and maybe you have these ideas of running your fingers through their hair or something like this. Then imagine that you're going to have a meal with this desirable person, and you're going to have some intimate time together, and then you discover that their hair is over everything. It's in your food. It's on the plate. It's on the table. You look around, the place is covered with their hair. Like, that just all of a sudden kind of shifts your your perception or your relationship to it, to their hair. Or there's something that Tonjeff suggests as this idea of, you can think of maybe there's another part of their body that is attractive to you. And imagine what you would do if you opened a room, you walked into a room, you opened it in, and there was just that particular body part right there on the floor. That body part completely removed from everything else. Ugh. Right? Very different, a very different experience. This brings to mind somebody, a friend, a child of a friend, who was, I think, probably a preteen at this time, thought it would be really funny, you know, during Halloween time you can get these body parts, like arms that look really real. And I saying this about walking into a room and seeing the just a part on the floor. Somebody, I had this experience, right, where this preteen put this arm that they had gotten from the Halloween store, and I remember just yelping. But then we laughed and laughed and laughed. We had such a good laugh about it. So is there a way in which you can consider there are different body parts of this individual in which you're having a sensual desire? Or can you, if you think about part of all human bodies is liquids, right? We have the contents of our gut, we have saliva, we have all these types of liquids. Contents of the bladder, of course. What would you do if you saw a vat of that liquid? Like, wow, right? That's completely different. So there's a way in which you might use the imagination, be a little bit playful, and bring up things that are a little bit outrageous as a way to replace these thoughts that are unwholesome, that are unhelpful, just to get lost in sensual thoughts. And then maybe after this thinking of parts being in unusual places and in unusual ways, then maybe it's easier to come back to the breath. Maybe it's easier to come back to something that can really calm and settle the mind. It's true that we might also have thoughts of, you know, ill will or some aversion. And to replace those kinds of thoughts, the common teaching is to do some loving kindness, to do some metta, some goodwill. And I'm often instructing to just do goodwill wherever it's easy. So it doesn't have to be towards that person for whom you have ill will. That's a tall order to go from ill will to goodwill. But instead, just to shift over to whomever it's the absolute easiest. It could even be imaginary kittens. I saw some kitten videos the other day. Oh my goodness, right? There's something, it's a little heart melting. So if that's true for you, can you use your imagination for maybe it's imaginary kittens, or maybe there's somebody when you bring them to mind, your heart really softens. But also, Tanjeff, Tenisro Bhikkhu, he talks about one way to do goodwill for those you have ill will, which I think is can be a really fruitful way. And this recognition that we want to wish goodwill for those, for everybody. That's in our own best interest. We want the mind not to have ill will, but to have goodwill. So including those whom we find difficult. And can we wish for those with whom that we find difficult, can we wish them to learn how to be skillful in their actions so that they may find happiness? So we may use that as a phrase. May you learn to be skillful in your actions so that you might find happiness. And this we can wish for people, that they learn to be skillful so that they can be happy. Of course, we don't want them to continue suffering. We all recognize that when people are happy, they can take better care of others and take better care of themselves. So we can do some loving kindness, some metta, some goodwill practice for those we find difficult by saying something along the lines of, you can find your own words that are meaningful for you, but may you learn to be skillful in your actions so that you might find happiness. I think all of us can do this. We can wish this, which is a different, it's a shift away from the ill will, to wish them that they may learn skillfulness in their actions. And maybe with that, with us, we have this openness, this willingness that we could help show them if they wanted to, but that's extra. Only think about that if that's helpful. So the way in which we can use the mind as an ally, instead of just thinking that thoughts are, there should be no thinking, or that we should get ourselves sequestered into a cocoon where there's kind of a dullness, or to feel like we have to figure everything out, there's a way in which we can use our thoughts. We can replace our thoughts for the unwholesome and replace them with something wholesome. So actively use our mind as part of our meditation practice as a way to help the mind to settle and find more freedom. Help the heart settle and find more freedom. And so may our practice of finding more freedom be for the benefit of all beings everywhere. Thank you.